population, the pandemic would cause a baby boom.
The birth rate in the U.S. has fallen for the sixth straight year. The new report from the CDC says that births are now at their lowest level since 1979, falling 4% from a year ago. The agency recorded more than 3.6 million births in 2020, nearly 150,000 fewer than in 2019. The report also concludes that the fertility rate has fallen considerably under the replacement level, the rate necessary for a generation to replace itself. That's considered to be about 2,100 births per 1,000 women, with the rate for 2020 at around 1,700 births. From the USA Radio News Ohio Bureau, I'm Dan Naraki.
The Heritage Foundation has announced that they have stopped taking donations from big tech corporations. In October, the conservative group turned down a $225,000 donation from Google and returned a $150,000 gift from Facebook. You're listening to USA Radio News.
Hi, this is Dr. Joel Wallach, and I want to tell you that arthritis is not a genetic thing. It's not a disease of aging. Neither is osteoporosis. Get a hold of my book. It's All in Your Head. It goes into the 25 different diseases you get when you have osteoporosis of the skull. These are all reversible. You take the Healthy Bone and Joint Pack, the MSM, vitamin D3, stay away from all the bad foods, including gluten, and guess what? You'll regrow all your bones, including your skull and your legs and your hips and everything else. Contact us at usaradiohealth.com. That's usaradiohealth.com.
Chauvin juror Brandon Mitchell says he doesn't remember wearing or even owning a George Floyd-themed T-shirt, but turns out he wore the shirt at least twice. Mitchell wearing the shirt in August in Washington, D.C. during a march and now again in October during a podcast episode recording that was available on YouTube. Mitchell's impartiality and candor during jury selection is being called into question this week with the discovery of the online postings, and attorney Alan Dershowitz believes all this evidence is enough for a retrial.
I think that should cause a reversal of the conviction. You need 12 objective jurors unanimously to vote to convict in a criminal case. And in this case, you had at least one juror who seemed to have an agenda, and you have many, many other issues in the case as well. I think this case calls for a reversal and a new trial outside of Minneapolis in a small rural area.
House Republicans are questioning the Centers for Disease Control this week after newly released emails revealed the CDC quietly partnered with leading teachers' unions while crafting the latest school reopening guidelines, which many schools relied on to delay a return to in-person learning. The House Republicans, in a letter saying that the CDC is putting politics over science and Biden and Harris campaign donors over children. For USA Radio News, I'm Tim Berg.
Well, good afternoon, everybody. My name is Jim Gano, and this program is called Taking Care of Business. And for the next hour, we're going to talk about issues affecting businesses large and small here in the borough of Flemington, in beautiful Hunterdon County, New Jersey, and on the national scene as well. It's Thursday, May 6, 2021, and I'll have all that and more right now on Taking Care of Business. Well, once again, I want to thank everybody for joining me. I see everybody popping up on the screen. Thanks to Karen for watching and for Mike and for Bruce. Appreciate you stopping by. And we'll get to everybody else a little later on. But so glad you could join me on another edition of Taking Care of Business with Jim Gano as we get together every Thursday at 1 o'clock to talk about issues affecting businesses, both large and small. And one of the things we do, or that I like to do on the program, is bring different perspectives in, whether it's something that a national business does, a small business does, or whether it's a story that applies to ownership or management or down to the employee level. I try to bring something every week that everybody can benefit from. And I always tell my employees, and I hope that a lot of other businesses do this as well, but I really want employees to start thinking as if they are the owners of the company. Now, obviously, you don't have the financial risk. You know, if there's a loss, you're still getting paid. If there's a major profit, unless you have profit sharing, you may not be enjoying those successes. But I want you to think and act as if you own the business. And what that means is we're not watching the clock and saying, oh, you know, 5 o'clock can't come fast enough. But we're working towards how do we make the business better. And if the business gets better, chances are you're going to get more accounts, you're going to get more business, the business will thrive. We've seen over the last year hundreds of thousands of businesses that have gone under. We've seen entire industries that have suffered. My industry, for instance, the trophy and awards industry, was decimated. And a lot of those small mom-and-pop trophy shops have gone out of business because schools weren't in session, sports weren't being played, corporate accounts weren't recognizing employees. So if you didn't have a second revenue stream, which will be one of our stories later today, how to expand your business, you were pretty much stuck. And we saw that, the governor stated this was going to be a 2 or 3 week closure, and here we are 14 months later, and we're just starting to see those restrictions lifted. Governor Murphy announced earlier this week that on May 19th, all restrictions, indoor and outdoor, will be relieved. You'll still have to wear a mask. You'll still have to socially distance, which a lot of restaurants are complaining about, because when you enforce 6 foot spacing, it still means that certain tables can't be set or can't be used. I know I talked to one of the managers over at the Chimney Rock Inn, and she said it's nice, it sounds good on paper, but it's not really going to open us up to the capacity that we need. So it's one of those things that you have to constantly be monitoring and getting creative with. There's a new restaurant in Bridgewater called Tommy's Bar and Grill. Tommy's is based out of, I think, Seabright or somewhere down the shore. And he bought all the Zinburger locations, and he's redoing them. And I noticed in the one in Bridgewater, even though they had an outdoor patio on one side of the building, looking at the construction the other day, he's added one on the other side of the building, opposite the bar. So he's expanding his capability that way by increasing the footprint. Now, again, as we get closer to the winter months, that may have to shut down. But for now, he's at least doing what he can to survive and thrive. Hopefully, from what the governor said this morning, it sounds like he's going to take a look at possibly getting rid of these things, by Memorial Day, and also easing the restrictions even further. So hopefully we're getting there. And I think the magic number was 70% vaccination rate. Once we get to that point, then the restrictions can be eased. I'll be getting my second vaccination next Wednesday, I think it's the 12th, over at Hunterdon Central High School. Looking forward to that. My wife got her first one this week. Most of my family has been vaccinated, so it's going to be good to get back with them and exchange hugs and get back together with people. And I'm looking forward to all of that. And I don't care if they say you have to have a third shot in November. Okay, whatever. We'll deal with it. We're going to treat this kind of like the flu that we've done every year when you go get your flu shot. It's time for the business quote of the week, brought to you each week at this time by Crown Trophy of Flemington. I usually use celebrities, religious leaders, political leaders, famous people for the quote of the week. And this week, I remember that back in, I think it was 1983, I had come up with this quote in college. And so you can attribute this to me. I'm no celebrity by any stretch of the imagination. But there was a conversation with a professor in a lecture, and it got pretty heated, the whole conversation. And I got up, and I said the following sentence, and the whole room just stopped, and they were like, well, as simple as that sounds, it's still somewhat profound, but it's true. So the quote, business quote of the week is this: it's important at any moment to sacrifice what you are for what you can become. And what I meant by that, and what I still mean by that, because when I lecture businesses or when I consult with businesses, I will bring this quote to them, is that we're all at a certain level. The important thing is, at any moment, to be able to sacrifice what you are for what you can become. So what you are, even if you're successful or if you're struggling, is, are you willing to sacrifice that to get to the next level? And if so, what are you willing to do? What are you willing to sacrifice to do that? And I remember in the lecture hall, and there were maybe 200 or 300 people there, this really opened up a lively debate. And people were like, well, why should I do more? Or, yes, I'm willing to do more. So are you willing in your career either to get more experience, to take certification courses or anything like that? What are you willing to do to go from here up to here? And in my new book, which is hopefully coming out later this summer, called The Action Plan, it's a book written for business, I talk about this a lot because so many employees prior to the pandemic had a attitude, if you will. It seemed like there was an attitude of entitlement. Like, if I just show up every 2 weeks, you're going to give me a paycheck. And in the book, I talk a lot about the distractions, the constant Facebooking, the internet searches, checking personal emails, things that were taking away from your productive time. And I give a good math problem in there where we talk about productivity and how little people actually do during the day, but they want to get the full paycheck. And in effect, the net was people only work true productivity time about 75% of the year, but they want 100% of their paycheck. So what are you willing to do to earn all 100%? It's not a hard stretch. It's just, you know, take care of the personal business on personal time, not on work time. So we'll talk about that in upcoming episodes and try to get this country. And I think one of the things, and there's a story I'm going to talk about later from Jamie Dimon, who's the CEO of Chase, who talks about it the same way, comes at it from the same angle I do. When we come back to work, and we're starting to see pharmaceutical companies are telling their employees, hey, we're going to do this in phases. We're going to start in July, and then maybe in August or September we'll add more. They want to bring employees back into the office, providing, A, that they're comfortable going, that they've been vaccinated, and that their personal life will allow for it. So if you don't have daycare, if you're still going to be remote learning and teaching your children, you have to be there to help them with that, that may not allow for it. But as we get back into the normal structure of business where people are going into the office, even if it's only for a few days a week, I think we're going to have to be – I think the pressure is going to be on for us to be more productive, and that things that may have been acceptable 14 months ago or 2 years ago will not be acceptable in the new companies. We're hearing stories of companies that are going to eliminate entire levels of management because they've seen through the pandemic that certain people just aren't carrying their weight. And if they can't carry their weight, then we'll find the people who can. Or we may already have those people in lower level positions. We'll just give them more responsibility and more pay. An update on my new book, The Player. That came out. I didn't bring one with me today. I'm a very bad author that I didn't bring one with me. But the book, The Player, is still available for sale at Amazon.com, selling very well. Very happy with the results. And what's really great is I'm getting a lot of emails and text messages and Facebook lookups from people telling me that they've been reading the book. They're enjoying it. It's 420-some-odd pages, and one woman read it in a day. Hey, Ron, thanks for checking in. Appreciate it. And another woman wrote, she read it in 3 days. Another woman said it was excruciating. And I asked her, I said, what do you mean? You know, was it that bad? And she goes, no, it was excruciating because she wanted to spread it out over time. And the best she could do was a week. But she loved the story, loved the character development. And so it's great to see, to get that kind of feedback. Great to see the sales of the book are doing well. And I've already got two other projects in process, so I'm working on that, and I do want to get the business book, The Action Plan, released, hopefully by a September-October time frame, so that as people start to get back into work full-time in their offices, it'll be helpful for them. So I mentioned earlier that Jamie Dimon, who is the CEO of J.P. Morgan, had said that he doesn't think working from home is necessarily a good thing. And so as we go through the story, what he's basically saying is that if you want to get ahead in business, if you want to get ahead in your career, you're going to have to leave home and get back into the office. So Working from home does not work for everyone, especially those who want, quote unquote, to hustle, says J.P. Morgan Chase & Company's chief executive on Tuesday, Jamie Dimon, at a conference in New York. The largest American bank recently told its workers that it expects all U.S.-based employees back in offices on a rotational basis by early July, subject to current public health rules, which limit office capacity to 50%. Bank CEO Jamie Dimon said he wants people back at work because exclusively working from home doesn't work for young people. It doesn't work for those who want to hustle. It doesn't work for spontaneous idea generation. It doesn't work for culture, Dimon said at a conference hosted by the Wall Street Journal. Dimon said he is open to some employees working from home a few days a week, a policy other banks like Deutsche Bank, HSBC, and UBS are reportedly exploring as well. But starting on May 17th, Dimon said he wants employees back in the office a few days a week to reacclimate themselves to the workplace after working from home for over a year during the COVID-19 pandemic. Dimon's get used to it approach, which could include requiring employees get vaccinated, has faced a backlash. Dimon said he received a nasty email from an employee's wife who disagreed with the push to return to work. But that's life, Dimon said, saying the bank will be more competitive and work better for clients with employees meeting in person again. In my view, September, October, it will look just like it did before, and everyone's going to be happy with it, Dimon said. Where do you fall on that? I mean, it's a lot of people are saying that they don't feel that employers can mandate that they be vaccinated. And others are saying that, you know, hey, if I got vaccinated, the person sitting next to me should be vaccinated. So where do you fall on the spectrum as far as is it a good idea? Is it something like you think the employer is overstepping? Have you been fully vaccinated? So those are the questions that will have to be answered. I mentioned that my wife's company is going to start going back to work, I think 50%. They are mandating that in order for you to come back into the office, you will have to be fully vaccinated and you will be tested, I believe, either two or three times a week for the virus to make sure that you're not positive. So I think that I hate the term the new normal, but I think we're there. And I think what has to happen is that, you know, people have to understand that we obviously can't have this, you know, have people not vaccinated spreading the disease, and then, you know, we have a fourth or fifth cycle of infection. So as far as Jamie Dimon is concerned, if you're working for J.P. Morgan Chase, better get your shot in the arm if you plan on coming back to work. And he also speaks to something about the people who want to hustle. And one of the things that in a story I did about two or three weeks ago, was there was that balance of the people working from home and the people that were going into an office. And would it be fair? Would it be equitable? Or would the people who went into an office be looked at preferentially by management as someone who, not, I don't want to call it a sacrifice or anything like that, but because they're in the office, would they be more apt to get promotions? Would they be more apt to get ahead or better assignments, or in terms of payroll review, would they be more apt to get a better raise than somebody who was working from home? Last week, I told you the story of a lot of employers complaining, and you may have seen this in the area, I know I have, that it's hard to hire people right now. And I think the story, as I promoted it last week, was it's time to get off the couch and get back to work. And I even got some backlash on that, where people were saying, you know, why should I go back to work? I'm making more money on unemployment than I am when I was working. So there's a story out today. Unemployment benefits are not creating a worker shortage. And it really depends on where you're getting your news from. Some people are saying it is. Some people are saying it's not. I believe the state of Montana is going to discontinue unemployment to encourage people to get back to work. But if you've been paying attention, if you see, if you've been traveling around, you're probably seeing a lot of now hiring signs or help wanted signs or something like that. And people aren't answering the call for these. I did the story last week about the McDonald's in Tampa, Florida, that was offering $50 to anybody who would fill out an application. How hard is that? And yet they couldn't get enough people to fill out the applications. And if they did, once they started discussing salary, people didn't want to take the jobs because they were making more money on unemployment. With that said, once the extended unemployment benefits run out in September, providing they're not extended, what will happen then? People are going to rush to come back to work, but there's a good chance that their position would have been filled. So as the U.S. economy bounces back from the COVID-induced downturn, some employers say they're having a hard time finding workers. GOP lawmakers like David Rauser, who's from North Carolina, blame the safety net. This is what happens when you extend unemployment benefits too long and add a $1,400 stimulus payment, Rauser said on Twitter last week, posting a photo from a Hardee's that said it was closed due to a lack of staff. Right when employers need workers to fully open back up, few can be found. It's a dubious argument. Republicans said the same thing last year when Congress passed the big relief bill that added $600 per week to state unemployment benefits for 4 months. Democrats are going to make the next 4 months impossible for small businesses to hire, said Lindsey Graham of South Carolina. This bill creates an incentive for people to be unemployed for the next 4 months, said Rick Scott of Florida. And again, there was a great example where I think the math was something like if you get $600 per week on unemployment, that's the equivalent of $16 an hour. But if you were making $12, $13, or $14, where's the motivation to go back to work? Senator Ben Sasse, who's a Republican from Nebraska, said the benefits would knock this nation still harder in the coming months by unintentionally increasing unemployment. At the time, millions of workers were losing their jobs every week, and nobody knew how bad things would get. But a few weeks after the initial lockdowns, businesses started to recall workers. Millions returned to their jobs despite the extra benefits, and the jobless rate plunged. A spate of academic studies found the extra benefits weren't stopping people from going back to work after all. At $300 per week, the federal supplement is half what it was last year, but the criticism is twice as intense, even though the previous doomsaying didn't pan out. People get paid more not to work than to work, said Bill Cassidy, a senator from Louisiana, telling the Huffington Post, referring to the extra federal benefits. Economists talk about that, but anecdotally, it's not clear. It's true that the benefits amount to more than prior wages for some workers. It's just the extra money doesn't seem to have held workers back. The unemployment complaint fits a broader Republican argument that Democrats under President Joe Biden are out to destroy the American work ethic with their proposals for new parents' benefits and affordable child care. Think about what the Democrats have done, said Representative Kevin McCarthy from California, who's the House Republican leader. They have demonized work so Americans would become dependent on big government. While some employers may be struggling to hire for one reason or another right now, economists say generous unemployment benefits are not the cause. If demand for workers were exceeding supply, then the price of labor would be shooting up. But as Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell said last week, overall wage growth has not increased. We don't see wages moving up yet, and presumably we would see that in a really tight labor market, Powell said at a press conference, and we may well start to see that. So the question that has to be asked and isn't being asked is, how many jobs were there before the pandemic started? How many jobs are there now? And is it out of balance? You know, so I'm going to throw numbers out there. Let's say there were 3 million jobs available before the pandemic that couldn't be filled. And now there are 6 million jobs that can't be filled. Then you could say that the economy, the businesses themselves, are looking to hire more than they needed before. But if it's a case where there were 3 million before and now there's like 1.5, then yes, you could make the argument that people just simply weren't returning to work. For now, unemployment remains elevated at 6% compared to 3.5% before the pandemic, and there were 4 million more unemployed people in March of 2021 than in February 2020. That data reflects people who are trying to find jobs, not those who have removed themselves from the workforce for a number of reasons, like a lack of childcare. Yet some business owners still say there are no willing workers out there. Chef Andrew Gruel, owner of Slapfish Restaurant franchise, took to Twitter last week to declare there are no employees available in California. Gruel said his eateries were offering $21 per hour, but couldn't find any takers. The top reason? They are making enough on unemployment and would rather not work. William Spriggs isn't buying that. The chief economist at the AFL-CIO Labor Federation, Spriggs said it is self-evident that millions of people are trying to find work. Just because an employer hasn't found them yet at the wages the employer is willing to pay, doesn't mean the workers aren't out there. Sprigg said the normal hiring networks that employers rely on were blown up by the pandemic. Some employers who received forgivable government loans were able to keep their workers on the payroll, but many firms simply let them go during lockdown. A year later, many of those workers have taken other jobs, moved on, or even died. They tend to recruit using networks, friends and relatives of people they already hire, Sprigg said, and the problem when we decided we would handle this by separating people from their employer is we broke up those networks. Workers understand that unemployment benefits do not last forever. The federal benefits will expire this fall. He also said employers may be reluctant to pay market clearing wage, the pay necessary to attract workers to all the available work, especially at a time when many jobs have become more difficult and stressful due to the pandemic. Then they got shocked when they tried to expand and find out, I have to raise my wage. Huffington Post tried to ask the Hardee's restaurant in Rouser's tweet how much it had raised its starting pay to attract new workers, but no one answered the phone there. Powell, for his part, acknowledged some employers may be struggling to find people who want to work for them. He said workers might be wary of virus exposure or running into other obstacles to returning to work. In other words, there is still a plague going on. One big factor would be schools aren't open yet, so there are people who are at home taking care of their children that would like to be back in the workforce but can't get there yet. In the aftermath of the Great Recession, many employers lamented that they couldn't find workers, even amid high levels of unemployment, prompting some commentators to proclaim a lack of skills among American workers. The federal government wasn't boosting weekly jobless pay at the time. But what we saw was that labor supply generally showed up, Powell recalled. In other words, if you were worried about running out of workers, it seemed like we never did. The loudest complaints of a worker shortage now seem to come from restaurants as more people resume their pre-pandemic dining out habits thanks to widespread vaccination. The National Restaurant Association, an industry lobbying group, says a variety of factors, not just benefits, contribute to hiring difficulties. With fewer people in the workforce, the stimulus support still in place, worker safety concerns, need for caregivers to remain at home, and much greater competition with other industries for workers, operators are returning to pre-pandemic recruitment techniques for hiring. The association's Hudson Real said in a statement, wages may have raised a bit faster than average this year in the hospitality industry, according to the government's Employment Cost Index, though state minimum wage laws may have played a role. In general, restaurant work doesn't pay very much, with median wages around $11 for servers in 2020, compared to more than $20 across most occupations. Many restaurant jobs are also much different than they used to be, with more outside seating, for example, plus masks and new cleaning protocols, not to mention new risks of getting sick. Some restaurant workers recently told Eater that they're willing to work, they just want pay that reflects the hazards. It's difficult to square the notion of a shortage of food service workers with a strong job growth in that industry, said Heidi Scheierholz, who's a former chief economist at the Labor Department, saying that dining and drinking establishments added 176,000 jobs in March, the biggest gain in any sector. I'm sure that labor supply is lower than it would be if we didn't have COVID, but that doesn't mean that there's a labor shortage. So it's interesting to see how people are weighing this. In some instances, employers are blaming unemployment benefits, and in others are saying there's really not that issue. So if you're out of work and you haven't gone back to work, what's holding you back? Is it the position? Is it the pay? Is it the benefits? Are you afraid of the virus and the exposure? Let me know. You can email me at trophyjim@yahoo.com, and we'll share your stories on an upcoming episode of Taking Care of Business. You are listening to Taking Care of Business right here on HuntingtonChamberRadio.com and WHCRDB. We're going to take a quick break for the news, and when we come back, we're going to talk about what happened to the flu in 2020. We'll be right back.
USA Radio News with Tim Berg.
First-time claims for unemployment benefits are coming in lower than expected. There were 498,000 initial claims last week, which is 92,000 fewer than the previous week's revised total. That's also the lowest number of first-time claims since March 14th of 2020. All that being said, Tony Frank is a restaurant owner in Toledo, Ohio. He says he can't find people to work. He blames it on the stimulus money.
I think the first round of the stimulus money was good. I think the extra unemployment money was good because we were shut down as a country. I understand that. For $700, people who are making $800, $900 will make sacrifices in their life and take things away to be able to sit home. In my opinion, we'll sit home for that $700.
President Biden spending his Thursday on the road promoting his infrastructure plan in Louisiana. You're listening to USA Radio News.
Why do you think bank presidents and jewelry store owners trust ADT to protect their homes and businesses? Because they feel safe, and you can too. How would you like to monitor your home from fire, floods, and yes, robberies without even being there right from your smartphone? That is peace of mind. You may even save money on your homeowner's insurance just by having an ADT system installed. And there's even a money-back guarantee. How about that? We guarantee 100% satisfaction. You have nothing to risk. Why do you think people who have so much to protect trust ADT? Because it works. Call right now for a free quote. We'll even give you a free gift for calling. So pick up your phone and call Protect Your Home, an ADT authorized premier provider now.
800-818-0191. 800-818-0191. 800-818-0191. That's 800-818-0191.
You're listening to Taking Care of Business right here on HuntingtonChamberRadio.com, www.HuntingtonChamberRadio.com, and WHCRDB. So glad you could join me. Or you're listening or watching on our Facebook Live stream on the show's page, Taking Care of Business with Jim Gonneau. Again, glad you could join me as we get together every Thursday at 1 o'clock to talk about issues affecting businesses large and small, both here in Flemington and on the national scene as well. There is a strange phenomenon that happened as a result of COVID. And I'll never forget, I was watching the news last September, and I was watching, I think, NBC Nightly News, and it was the first time that I heard the word twindemic. And they were talking about the flu and the coronavirus hitting at the same time. And I turned around to my wife and I said, did you just hear that word, twindemic? I mean, we got threats from all sides now. But there have been fewer influenza cases in the United States this flu season than in any on record. About 2,000 cases have been recorded since late September, according to data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. In recent years, the average number of cases over the same period was about 206,000. As measures to stop the spread of the coronavirus were implemented around the country in March of 2020, influenza quickly disappeared, and it still has not returned. The latest flu season, which normally would have run until next month, essentially never happened. After fears that a twindemic could batter the country, the absence of the flu was a much-needed reprieve that eased the burden on an overwhelmed healthcare system. But the lack of exposure to the flu could also make the population more susceptible to the virus when it returns, and experts say its return is certain. We do not know when it will come back in the United States, but we know it will come back, said Sonia Olson, who's an epidemiologist at the CDC. Experts are less certain about what will happen when the flu does return in the coming months as millions of people return to public transit, restaurants, schools, and offices. Influenza outbreaks could be more widespread than normal, they say, or they could occur at unusual times of the year. But it's also possible that the virus that returns is less dangerous, having not had the opportunity to evolve while it was on hiatus. We don't really have a clue, said Richard Webby, a virologist at the St. Jude Children's Research Hospital in Memphis, Tennessee. But it's possible that, we haven't had an influenza season this low, I think, as long as we've been measuring it, so what the potential implications are a bit unclear. Scientists do not yet know which public health measures were most effective in eradicating the flu season. But if behaviors like mask wearing and frequent hand washing continues after the coronavirus pandemic is over, they could help keep influenza at bay in the United States. Also, the hand sanitizing. Much also depends on the latest flu vaccines, their effectiveness, and the public's willingness to get them. The recent drop in cases, however, has made it difficult for scientists to decide which flu strains to protect against in those vaccines. It's harder to predict which strains will be circulating later, they say, when so few are circulating now. So what happened to the flu? When the reality of the coronavirus pandemic set in last year, the country was still in the throes of the normal flu season, which had peaked in February. Then schools closed, travel halted, and millions began working from home, and the number of new flu cases quickly dropped to historic lows, even as the coronavirus surged. And the decline has not been because of a lack of testing. Since late September, 1.3 million specimens have been tested for influenza, more than the average of about 1 million in the same period in recent years. The public's history of exposure to influenza, scientists say, may partially explain why the flu virtually disappeared while the coronavirus continued to spread after safety measures were implemented. For something like COVID, where you have a fully susceptible population at the start of a pandemic, it takes a lot more work to slow the spread of the infection, said Richard Baker, an epidemiologist at Princeton University. In other words, unlike the coronavirus, the population has some natural immunity to the flu from years of being exposed to various strains of the virus. People are susceptible to new strains of the flu each year, but less so than they are to wholly unfamiliar viruses. The mere presence of the coronavirus may have also played a role in suppressing flu cases, says Webby, because there is often just one dominant respiratory virus in a population at a given time. One tends to keep the other out. And influenza was not the only virus that disappeared over last year. There were also substantial drops in other respiratory illnesses, including the respiratory syncytial virus, or RSV, which is the most common cause of pneumonia in infants. What will happen when the flu returns? Influenza is a relatively common illness that has the potential to become deadly, especially among young children, seniors, and adults with chronic health conditions. The CDC estimates that the flu has killed 12,000 to 61,000 people a year since 2010. If immunity to the flu declined during the pandemic because of the lack of exposure to the latest flu strains, more people than usual may be susceptible to the virus. Every year, anywhere between 20 to 30% of the population gets its immunity sort of boosted and stimulated by being exposed to the flu virus. We are not going to have that this year, Webby said. Decreases in natural immunity are a concern, said Olson, and lower immunity could lead to more infections and more severe disease. The result could mean larger and out-of-season outbreaks of the flu and of RSV, Baker said. In Florida, in fact, RSV would normally be on the decline at this time of the year, but it is having an uptick. If offices and schools begin to reopen in greater numbers in the fall, as many expect, scientists will be watching closely. We're always concerned about influenza causing severe disease, particularly in persons at increased risk of complications. We know that school-aged children are important drivers of influenza virus transmission. However, because influenza is difficult to predict, we cannot forecast the severity of next season, Olson said. There's also a potential upside of the absence of influenza. Fewer cases usually lead to fewer mutations. Right now, because influenza isn't circulating as much, it's possible the virus has not had as much opportunity to evolve, said Baker, meaning our vaccines could be much more effective than normal. Choosing the strains for the flu vaccine is difficult. Creating the vaccine this year has been more difficult than in the past. Every year, scientists evaluate the strains of influenza that are circulating around the world and meet to decide which strains to protect against in that year's vaccine. They look at the strains that are getting people sick and use that information to predict which strains are most likely to infect people that flu season. We met at the end of February to make recommendations, said Webby, referring to the WHO panel that assesses the flu vaccine, and it was tricky. The amount of data was orders of magnitudes less than it typically is. Olson, the CDC epidemiologist, pointed out that the vaccine choices are based on more than just existing strains. Scientists also consider other data, including forecasts of the likelihood of any emerging groups of influenza viruses becoming more prevalent in coming months. And she said the uncertainty around the return of the flu makes getting vaccinated against the flu more important, not less. There's another hard-to-predict factor that could play a significant role when the flu comes back: whether society will carry on behaviors learned in the pandemic that benefit public health. Will mask wearing become the norm? Will employers give their employees more physical space? Will we still be using hand sanitizer? Will we be washing our hands? The last time Americans had a chance to make those behaviors part of their culture, Baker pointed out, they did not. The 1918 influenza pandemic should have been something that gave us some sort of societal learning, said Baker, but behavior did not change. So what is the journey you're about to go on from the COVID-19 pandemic along that axis, she added? Will you wear your mask even if no one else is? It's funny. I was with some friends over the weekend, and we were all talking. I said, remember how you used to look at people in the airport and they might be wearing a mask. And what are you doing? What are they wearing a mask for? And now we're all wearing masks. So will you continue that after the pandemic has subsided? And then will you also look at other behavioral changes? A lot of people used to go to work when they were sick because they didn't, want to infect people, or they didn't want to miss work, things like that. Will you continue to do that, or will you be more of the mindset of, I have to go to work and my job depends on it, so too bad? Will you send your children to school if they're sick? So a lot to consider. It'll be interesting to watch how America responds to this news, and it'll be interesting to see how the flu rebounds in the fall, if it takes till the fall. I want to talk to you about back on the track of business, and that is ways to encourage employee development at your company. Now, one of the things that has happened in a lot of companies is that the employees are feeling disengaged, disenfranchised from the company. They're working from home. They're completing their assignments. They're getting their work done, but they're having very little interaction with their boss. And I think I mentioned on last week's show the need, if you're having Zoom meetings, everybody has to turn the camera on. You can't just have this black box that says Bill, because nobody knows what Bill looks like. And I told you the story where a woman worked in my wife's company. My wife actually trained her, and she made it there for a year. But in that time, there was no real onboarding. There was no face-to-face meeting. She interviewed online, got the job. They mailed her a computer. They set her up. They had her meet with my wife, and my wife trained her on how to work the computer. And then, it was just do your work, do your job. And I think one of the things you have to do to not only encourage employee development but engagement is you have to, I would probably say weekly, even if it's a 15-minute Zoom call with your department. How's everybody doing? How are you handling the pandemic? How is the homeschooling going? How is, is your family okay? Is anybody sick? Things like that. We're not getting that anymore, and as a result, people are feeling less and less connected to their company. So there are four ways to encourage employee development at your company, and this month we're going to focus on employee development and training, as well as recognizing employees for reaching their developmental goals. This topic dovetails nicely with what I talked about last month about employee engagement going hand in hand. Employee development is all about gaining engaged employees from the very start, but creating a culture in which everyone is encouraged to learn and grow, the return on your investment will be astounding. So first, you want to create opportunities to learn. And there's so many ways to create learning opportunities through your company. The first and obvious is with cross-training. By training in a variety of jobs or departments, the employee has a better understanding of how things work on a larger scale, and your team has more flexibility when delegating tasks. I always associate this statement with a machine. And if you look at your company, there's various departments. You have your account, let's use an insurance company, for instance. you have your accounting department, actuarial department, underwriting department, rating, commercial lines, personal lines, claims. Think of each department as a gear. Now, if you're in one department, let's say personal lines, and you're only spinning that gear, but you don't know what the other departments do, or you don't know how they interact, then you just feel like, well, I'm on this little island. But when you expose them to other departments, even if it's on a small one-month rotation or a couple-month rotation, and they see the importance of the work of the other departments, then they see how they all work together to create this company. By providing professional learning sessions, have a coach come in to host a workshop on public speaking or pitching projects. Take the time to assess what specific skills your company could benefit from and what your employees would be interested in learning. Not only will they benefit individually, but so will the company as a whole. And third, promote learning outside of office hours to provide resources for online classes and certification programs. Tuition reimbursement is also becoming a desired perk due to the high cost of college courses. Companies who are able to provide tuition reimbursement see a return on their investment because the employee feels more invested in it. So there's a couple of different opportunities that you can create to help your employees learn. The next topic is one that I think a lot of employees, this is a stumbling block, and that is upward mobility. Is there a chance for promotion? And if so, do they have a roadmap or a path, if you will, for that? Now, as the word development suggests, there's an ongoing process, a movement from one state to another. Prevent employees from feeling stuck by creating a structure of upward mobility. Allow them to climb the ladder and see that their hard work is indeed paying off. And then recognize these achievements with proper emotion and ceremony. Devoted employees are each their own success story and should be rewarded. But lay out a timeline. You know, it's not enough to say upward mobility. It's not enough to say I'm going to promote you. It's not enough to say here's a raise. If you sit them down and you say, this is where you are. This is where I'd like you to be. It's going to take you 24 months to get there. If you achieve these milestones, then we're going to get you to that level quicker. That, to me, is the best way because now they have a goal or something to work toward. So hopefully, as we discuss upward mobility, you're not just throwing these out to keep people happy. They're earning them, and then you're rewarding them as a result. You also need to give, this is one area where, particularly in COVID, I think a lot of companies have dropped the ball, and that is giving your employees regular feedback. Check in with employees regularly and let them know that you're paying attention and that you care about them. Giving constructive criticism can be tough at first, but it's better to do it sooner than later when it develops into a larger problem. Employees expect a level of feedback and guidance, so don't be afraid to kindly suggest improvements. Ask about their pain points and what skills they want to learn. It's not enough to say what you want them to learn, but is there something else in their business, in their job function, or maybe not in the job function, but in an area that they want to work in, that that you can steer them in the right direction? Maybe you have a person working in an insurance company in underwriting, but they really have an interest in claims. How can we get them the certification they need and then get them that work? That may be a different career trajectory than what you had planned for them, but it may be an area that they want to be a part of. And then encourage networking. No matter what your industry is, there is always a relevant organization or an association to join. Provide employees with the resources on these associations and information on how to join. Consider waiving membership fees as well. This is a great way to get people networking, learning, and staying active in their industry. Create opportunities for employees to participate at conferences or trade shows too. It can be a fun change of pace, and most importantly, it establishes trust in them as the face of the company. When it comes to networking, I think it's also important for companies to encourage their employees to kind of look outside. So are they connected on LinkedIn? Are they following the right people? You may tell them, hey, you know, there's this person in our industry. I think you need to follow them on LinkedIn. They're writing some great articles. Comment on those posts. Is there a particular person in the industry that you could have either come in physically as a guest speaker, join the group on a Zoom call? Maybe you have to pay that person as a speaker, but at least if they're the type of person that is a leader in the industry, they're engaging and they can do a good presentation, invite them in so that you keep your group as engaged as possible. So those are some things that you ought to think about in keeping your employees engaged in their job, in their business, and a way to increase employee development. The next topic I want to talk about, and I don't want to call it scary, but it's something that when email first came out, we thought that was end all be all. We couldn't possibly advance any further as a civilization. You know, I can type a memo and hit send and it can appear on your computer in nanoseconds. And so we all thought it was great. And then two things happened. Sometimes emails got too long. And sometimes there were too many people attached to the email. Somebody would hit reply all, and all of a sudden we're seeing all these strings. So There is a tiny yet brilliant short email rule that one web designer created to manage his overflowing inbox problem. One day in the next week or so, I want you to count both work-related, spam-related, personal-related emails that you get in a given day. So starting at midnight to midnight, don't delete anything. But at the end of the day, count how many emails there were. I would be willing to bet that I probably get somewhere between 400 and 500 emails per day. A lot of it is junk. A lot of it is vendors sending me information. Hey, Lisa, thanks for joining. Sending me a sales flyer or something like that. So I don't necessarily need that right now. But see how much of your day is being occupied by email. We've talked about the hacks of not replying to every email as you receive it, but letting them come in and then taking an hour break and responding to those emails and then getting back to work and then maybe 2 or 3 hours later doing the same thing. You'll find yourself being more productive than the constant start-stop. But our days right now are defined by a barrage of incoming messages and back-and-forth digital conversations. It's a state of constant, anxious chatter which nobody can disconnect, and so nobody has the cognitive bandwidth to perform substantial work. And what I mean by that is I send you an email with 2 or 3 questions, and you reply to 2 of those questions. Now I have those answers, but I still need that third, so I send you another, and maybe I tack on a 4th and 5th question. And you respond to 2 of those. It's this constant back and forth, back and forth. In the old days, there was this great invention called the telephone. And I tell my staff this all the time. Rather than going back and forth, rather than constantly bothering the person on the other end and then bothering you and interrupting both of you, pick up the phone. Hey, Bob, I have these questions. Can you answer them? Get those answers and move on. But so many times we just rely on this back and forth, and I see it all the time in business. People are emailing like crazy, or they're getting text messages from a customer on the phone. I have customers that, you know, and I just went through it today, sent me a plaque order on Facebook Messenger with all of the engraving. This thing was monstrously long. And I'm like, wait, now how am I going to transfer it from Facebook Messenger over to like a Word document? It's like it was a nightmare. So create one form of communication you want to work with and then stick to it, but keep it short. Now, there was a time when tools like email felt, like I said, cutting edge. But research reveals that the workflow they help create has become a productivity disaster, reducing profitability and perhaps even slowing overall economic growth. Equally worrisome is that it makes us miserable. Humans are simply not wired for constant digital communication. We have become so used to an inbox-driven workday that it's hard to imagine any brilliant alternatives. But they do exist. So in 2007, there was the beginning of what we call the short email movement. A web designer named Mike Davidson posted an essay on his personal blog titled "A Lo-Fi Solution to Email Overload," in which he describes his frustrations with the asymmetric nature of email communications. Oftentimes, the senders will ask 2 or 3 open-ended, one-sentence questions, which elicit multi-paragraph answers, he writes. And in these cases, the sender spends 1 minute, while the receiver is asked implicitly to maybe spend 3 or 4. We have become so used to an inbox-driven workday that it's hard to imagine any brilliant alternatives. Davidson's solution? Keep all of his emails short. He identified the 160-character count of an SMS text message as a reasonable target, but recognizing that counting characters would require some sort of special software plugin, he instead used a simple approximation. He would keep all of his emails to 5 sentences or less. To politely explain this rule to his correspondents, Davidson launched a simple website that briefly explains the policy on a minimalist landing page. He then added the following signature to the bottom of all his emails. Question: why is this email 5 sentences or less? Answer, and he gives the website, http://5, sentence, sentence.es. As Davidson concludes in his introductory post, by ensuring that all emails I send out take the same amount of time to send, I am evening the playing field between emails and attending to many more of them in the end. Davidson calls the policy a huge difference, adding that What makes it all the more easy is that before I even give my response, I already know it's going to be five sentences max. So there is little reason to procrastinate about this. The short email movement might be a pain in the moment, but it's a protocol that will deliver a lower average cost in the long run. The idea of strictly limiting email length is more than a gimmick. It instead represents a step that too few take in our current digital age, the placing of clear constraints around what email should and should not be used to accomplish. The hyperactive hive mind workflow wants email to be a neutral carrier that supports flexible, unstructured, ongoing conversations of all types. The short email movement pushes back on this commitment. It specifies email as something useful for short questions, short answers, and short updates, but demands that anything more complicated be handled using a different type of communication better suited to the exchange. This might be a pain in the moment, but it's a protocol that, again, will deliver a huge average cost in the long run. I had a conversation with a woman this morning, Jenny Clark from the Star Thrower Group. We're going over a couple of things. We were probably on the phone for about 30 to 35 minutes. If all of that dialogue took place via email, it would have tied up both of our days. So sometimes it's better just grab the phone, get your questions answered, and move on. And other times, you know, keep it simple, keep it short, get the answers you need, and move on. Had a lot going on this week. We had May the 4th be with you. We had Cinco de Mayo. I don't know of anything for today, like, you know, Sace Day, whatever. Obviously this weekend we got a big one coming up. It's Mother's Day. So hopefully you will take care of Mom if she is still with you. And if not, make sure you take time to remember her. And for all the moms out there, happy Mother's Day and congratulations on being a mom. I know my daughter-in-law is a mom now twice, so she'll be able to have double the excitement of that with my new granddaughter with her. And hopefully you'll have a great weekend, great weather, and you'll be able to enjoy that as well. What else is coming up? If you get a chance, I'm going to post it on the radio show page, but there was a great article on NJ.com yesterday about the Star Thrower Group, which I'm a member of the board there. Terrific article. They're doing great work over there, and hopefully you'll be able to read that as I post that a little later on this afternoon. But check out the Star Thrower Group, and we hope to have Jenny Clark, the founder of the Star Thrower Group, on the program in a couple of weeks. Well, as always, it's been my pleasure joining you today, and I always end the program with some great advice I got from my father when I was just 6 years old that guides me in my personal and professional life every day when he said, "Never let it rest until your good is better, and your better is best." If you have ideas for upcoming program topics or guests, email me at trophyjim@yahoo.com, or you can connect with me on LinkedIn, on Twitter at JimGaneau83, or on Facebook on the show's page, Taking Care of Business with Jim Ganeau. For more information about me and my businesses or books, visit www.jimganeau.com. I'm Jim Ganeau, and I'm taking care of business. Make it a productive week, everybody.
USA Radio News with Tim Berg.
Texas Democrat Henry Cuellar, who has been critical of the White House's immigration policies, said that recent photos from border facilities in southern Texas are misleading. Cuellar is suggesting the Department of Homeland Security agency that operates the Border Patrol facilities is falsely creating the impression that the facility in Donna, Texas, has been cleared of unaccompanied children. However, he says those kids have just been moved to another nearby facility that's being operated by the Department of Health and Human Services. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is making it clear the United States stands with Ukraine against any Russian aggression.
Our commitment to Ukraine's independence, its territorial integrity, its sovereignty, we stand with them.
Biden speaking there on NBC News, and you're listening to USA Radio News.
Hello, this is Wayne Alaroot for our newest sponsor, Asset Strategies, or ASI for short. ASI is a precious metals powerhouse. They sell gold and silver. Never in history has there been a more important moment to buy gold and silver. ASI has been in business for 39 years. They've served over 20,000 clients and sold $5 billion worth of gold, silver, and precious metals with zero complaints. Last year, gold saw gains of 25%. Silver nearly doubled gold's performance. Now Democrats are in charge. Green New Deal, open borders, free healthcare for illegals. Bailout broke cities and states. The debt is about to go through the stratosphere. The time to buy is now. The owners of ASI, Michael and Rich Chekin, have been my close personal friends for 16 years. ASI is the company I trust when it comes to buying and selling precious metals. Call now to receive a free consultation and a free 1 ounce silver eagle with every qualifying purchase when you mention the Wayne Alaroot Show. Call 800-831-0007. That's 800-831-0007. Or visit assetstrategies.com.
After the death of a child and dozens of injuries, the Consumer Product Safety Commission has announced Peloton has finally agreed to recall about 125,000 of its treadmills.
After first declaring the $4,200 treadmills were safe, as long as all warnings and safety instructions were followed, Peloton has now agreed to the full recall.